Chapter 8. Mirena had been in the jungle for a week before Dr. Alan Saturn, whom she thought of as the first Dr. Saturn, said he would borrow Easter and the boat and make a trip to the trading post 2 hours away to mail some letters. The trading post was not a trading post at all, but a larger village downriver, where the more advanced Jinta Indians had their camp. They were, for a small price, willing to hold letters and money until a trader passed through from Manaus, which they did with some frequency. For a larger price, the traders would then take the letters back with them to mail. No small request, as the mail was going to Java and Dakar and Michigan, and they themselves were not men born with a natural inclination to stand in long post office lines. Once the trip was established, everyone save Dr. Swenson broke from work to sit down for some time after lunch to commit themselves to paper. Dr. Booty gave Mirena 3 blue tissue aerograms from her considerable stack, and Alan Saturn said he would stand her for the stamps. Mirena, whose luggage had yet to be recovered, had spent the past 7 days in her Lakashi dress, though she had been given an identical spare out of either guilt or compassion by an anonymous tribe member. Nancy Saturn, the second Dr. Saturn, had given her 2 extra pairs of underwear, and Thomas Nkomo had a toothbrush still in the plastic wrap. He put it in her hand very discreetly. It seemed to Mirena that these were among the kindest gifts of her existence.
"This is why I don't loan out the boat," Dr. Swenson said, looking around the lab as the doctors scattered with paper and pens, those charming dinosaurs of communication. "Once you say it's leaving, no one seems to think there's any work to do."
But work was all there was to do. Mirena had been set up in the corner of the lab and been given the job of running tests on the compound for stability, to see whether it was degrading with heat and exposure. Like Anders, she was a small molecule person. Their work had been in pills, and while it wasn't an exact match for the task at hand, it was comfortably within her realm of experience. There was enough data piled up to keep her busy for years, and she wondered if that wasn't Dr. Swenson's objective, to keep her busy. It was possible that they were feeding her problems they had already solved as a means of placating her or testing her competence. They had mice, after all. They were clearly already on to testing the concentration of the compound in blood levels. Still, she knew that if she stayed in her corner looking over what they had given her, she would be much more able to make a realistic assessment of how far they were from a first efficacious dose. She could sidle over to Dr. Booty from time to time. Booty was in charge of clinical research organization, and ask her questions about the Lakashi blood work. She could see now how ridiculous it had been to simply ask Dr. Swenson over dinner what her progress was. Working here, she had the chance to make her own assessment, and that was what Mr. Fox had wanted all along. Mirena understood the look of panic on his face, and besides, if she wasn't working, what was she going to do with her days? The jungle, with its screeching cries of death and slithering piles of leaves, was hardly a place to go walking alone in the afternoons. 2 of the young men from the tribe had dreams of learning English and German and becoming tour guides at one of the eco-lodges hundreds of miles away. They had seen the great white hope of the cruise ships while riding bundles of trees to Manaus. They had met the naturalists when visiting the Jinta. Because they were always looking to practice, they were willing to take a restless doctor into that deeper place off the available paths where the afternoon light was filtered out by leaves. With a great deal of hand gesturing, a few common words in 4 different languages, and a couple of glossy field guides with the name Anders Ekman printed inside the front cover, they would endeavor to give jungle tours, pointing out the neon-colored frogs the size of dimes that contained enough poison in their clammy skins to take down 20 men. The scientists all agreed that they had never been deep into the jungle for more than 8 minutes without thinking they would give everything they owned to be led safely out. Sometimes, in the late afternoons when the generator stumbled from the burdens of overuse, and the scant electricity in the lab clicked off altogether, save the backup generators that kept the blood samples in the freezers flash frozen to Arctic levels, the heat drove the doctors, save Dr. Swenson, into the river to swim,
though the river was even worse than the jungle because in that murky soup there was no telling what was coming at you. As they treaded the water slowly, hoping not to kick up an attractive splash, the conversation turned not to the spectacular moth with wings the size of handkerchiefs that for a moment hovered over their heads, but to the microscopic candiru fish that were capable of swimming up the urethra with catastrophic results. Morena, who had no alternative, swam in her dress and hoped that in the slow agitation of her strokes she was washing it. They kept an eye out for water snakes, whose heads rode the surface of the river like tiny periscopes, and reminisced about the vampire bats that had tangled their claws in the mosquito nets over their beds. No one stayed long in the water, not even Dr. Booty, who apparently had been something of a swimming star in Indonesia when she was a girl. For entertainment not reliant on nature, there were outdated scientific journals and old New Yorkers, but invariably something had eaten through the most interesting paragraphs. Dr. Swenson had a complete set of hardbacked Dickens, and she kept the books wrapped separately in heavy pieces of plastic tarp and tied with twine. She would loan them out and then do spot checks to make sure they were being read with clean hands. A cinnamon stick was lodged in the plastic wrap of each volume, as ants, Dr. Rapp had once told her, would always avoid the scent of cinnamon. Dr. Swenson believed that ants would be the standard bearers for the end of civilization. Other than the brief and unsatisfying diversions of walking and swimming and reading, all that was left for Dr. Swenson and Dr. Singh, Dr. Nkomo and Dr. Booty and the two Drs. Saturn, was the lab, and the lab was not unlike a Las Vegas casino. They existed there without calendar or clock. They worked until they were hungry, and then they stopped and ate, opening a can of apricots and another can of tuna. They worked until they were tired, and then they went back to their cots in the small ring of huts that sat behind the lab, like the bungalows at the Spiro Wigwam summer camp for girls at Mille Lacs. They read some Dickens before they went to sleep. At the end of her first week, Morena was halfway through Little Dorrit. Of all her possessions lost and gone, she was particularly sorry to be without her James novel. As for the Lakashi, they were patient subjects, submitting themselves to constant weighing and measurement, allowing their menstrual cycles to be charted and their children to be pricked for blood samples. Dr. Swenson deserved the credit for that, and she accepted it readily, telling stories about the tireless cajoling and gift-giving that had once been required for even the most basic examinations. "I tamed them," she said, not taking the least discomfort in the word. "It was our life's work, Dr. Rapp's and mine, earning their trust." But if she taught them to tolerate her research, she had not made them good company. They rarely offered to share their dried fish and regurgitated manioc root, not that anyone wanted it, but it was the most basic lesson in any introduction to anthropology class. The sharing of food was the primary symbol of harmonious communal living. Then again, Dr. Swenson strictly forbade the sharing of the scientists' food among members of the tribe, as she believed that a jar of peanut butter was more corrupting to indigenous ways than a television set. So it was possible that the Lakashi's unwillingness to offer up their bread was only a matter of passive retaliation. It was Easter alone who ate from both tables, or, more accurately, both pots. The Lakashi didn't knock on the door of the lab to extend an invitation on the nights they decided for no discernible reason to dance until 3 in the morning. And they left no note when they cleared out, all of them together, which they did from time to time, leaving behind the most unnerving silence. When they came back 12 hours later, they were red-eyed and quiet, walking on their toes in their collective indigenous hangover. Even the children smelled of a peculiar smoke and sat like stumps on the bank of the river, an entire line of them staring straight ahead without scratching their insect bites. "We used to call it a vision quest in honor of the indigenous Americans," Dr. Swenson had said when Morena ran to the lab in a sweat-soaked panic, asking what had happened to everyone. She had been in camp 3 days when, in the manner of a horrible scene from a science fiction movie, they all disappeared. That was the perfect name for what they were doing until it also became the name of a video game and the rallying cry for every pack of middle-aged New Agers who were looking to legitimize their interest in psychedelics. I don't have a name for it anymore. I wake up and see they're gone and I think, oh, it's time for that again.
Have you ever gone with them? Marina asked.
Dr. Swenson was working through a complicated-looking equation in a spiral notebook, but she didn't seem to mind carrying on the conversation while she wrote down strings of numbers. There were computers in the lab, but between the undependable electricity and the overpowering humidity that from time to time seized the generators like a fever, everyone was more inclined to do their important calculations by hand, proving legions of math teachers correct. No one goes with them now. In retrospect, I think it was only Dr. Rapp they were inviting, and the rest of us held his coattails. Once he stopped coming on expeditions, the Lakashi simply went out in the middle of the night while we were sleeping. Never have I known a people who could 1 hour be as loud as a blitzkrieg and the next hour maintain perfect silence while walking through dried leaves. They can move their entire operation out of here without breaking a twig.
Marina waited for an answer to the question she had asked, but Dr. Swenson's attention had fallen back to the math before her. It occurred to Marina that these sorts of conversations were exactly the reason the Bovenders worked so hard to keep Dr. Swenson separated from society. Society was nothing but a long, dull dinner party conversation in which one was forced to speak to one's partner on both the left and the right.
But you did go.
Dr. Swenson glanced up for a moment, as if surprised to see Marina was still there.
Of course, when I was younger, it seemed fascinating at the time, as if we had discovered something central to the identity of the people. It was very important to Dr. Rapp. It was important to the entire field of mycology. I picture all those students now, boys from Park Avenue and Hyde Park and Back Bay, who had spent their previous summers in the Hamptons scooping ice cream, all marching off into the jungle ready to ingest anything that was given to them. The way they opened their mouths and closed their eyes, you would have thought the Lakashi were distributing communion. Actually, the ceremony would have made a striking program for interdisciplinary studies: biology, anthropology, world religion. I certainly found it compelling as a medical student to see how long a person could sustain such a low heart rate. In the whole lot of them, there wasn't a pulse over 24. I once brought a cuff with me and monitored the Lakashi and the students every 20 minutes for 5 hours after they had reached a state of unconsciousness. Their diastolic pressure ticked in slightly above dead. I was only testing for my own interest, but if I could have put together a committed control group, it could have been an important study over time.
Did you? Marina wasn't exactly sure how to phrase the question.
I did, of course, but mycology was never my field. I was more interested in recording the subjects. Let the botanist take notes on his own trip, I say. I was of great assistance to Dr. Rapp in this way. He never had a graduate student who was willing to abstain for purposes of observation. I didn't mind that, of course. I was glad to help the science. The real problem was the Lakashi themselves. Once the women realized I wasn't going on the trip anymore, they started piling all the babies around me, all the children. I put a quick stop to that.
The children were participating?
I suppose that conflicts with your ideas of good parenting. In retrospect, I can see how you would have preferred me to stop them, but I didn't know you at the time.
That's fine. I'm not interested in the children, Marina said, and in fact, she was telling the truth. From what she could tell, the Lakashi children were constructed out of titanium. They ate random berries and were bitten by spiders and fell out of trees and swam with piranha, and they were fine. She could hardly see how a regular dosing of hallucinogens could make a difference.
But when you did go on the trip, as you say, did you enjoy it?
Marina had given her youth to studying, believing all the propaganda of the dangers of drugs, while her worshipped professor was spending her weekends in the Amazon eating mushrooms. She felt she deserved to know, at least second hand, if it had been any fun.
Dr. Swenson took off her reading glasses and pressed her fingertips hard against the bridge of her nose. I keep hoping that you are more than you show yourself to be, Dr. Singh. I am just on the verge of liking you, but you dwell on the most mundane points. Yes, of course it was interesting to take part in the ritual. That was what we had come here to do. It was slightly terrifying the first time, all of the screaming and the smoke. In that way, it was a little like your experience coming up the river at night, except that you are all very close together in one giant enclosed hut. Seeing God was worthwhile, of course. I doubt seriously that anything in our Western tradition would have shown him to me so personally. I remember Dr. Rapp would feel quite humbled for several days after the experience and would continue to see a great deal of purple. We all would. But in the final assessment, I am a person who loathes vomiting. And there is a great deal of vomiting involved in the Lakashi ritual. It is an unavoidable part of the program. The body isn't capable of processing that amount of poison without... Dr. Swenson, who was sitting on a low stool in front of a table she used for her desk, closed her eyes as if she were remembering the experience. She kept her eyes closed for entirely too long. Dr. Swenson? She held up her hand and shook her head almost imperceptibly, warding off further questions. Then she stood up, looking watery and pale, and going quickly out the door, vomited next to the front steps. Dear Jim, it is true that no one here has a telephone. I believe it has something to do with the humidity, which is the enemy of all machines. While I am told there is an internet connection in a village several hours west of Manaus, which is nowhere near us anyway, it only works when there have been 2 entire weeks without rain, which means de facto no connection. The second phone you gave me, along with my second suitcase, disappeared after my arrival in the Lakashi village. I have been a poor steward of my belongings. It has been so long since I've been able to tell you where I am that I worry by now you must think I'm dead. I am hoping the mail service comes through for me and you get this letter quickly. I've been here a week, and this is my first hope of getting a letter out of the village, though Dr. Nkomo told me that when Anders was here, he would stand on the banks of the river with a letter in his hand and watch for any passing dugout canoe. What I most want to say is that you shouldn't worry about me. Life among the Lakashi has been better than expected. I have a small job in the lab, and over time I feel I will be able to discern how much real progress has been made on the drug. While everyone is friendly, no one is particularly forthcoming as to what aspects of the research they are responsible for. I will tell you that the pregnancies are astonishing. Ages are difficult to document in the older members of the tribe. Dr. Swenson began to document the children when she first arrived 50 years ago. But there are pregnant women here who seem clearly to be in their 70s. The more I see, the more I understand your commitment to this drug, no matter how much time it takes to reach the first human dose. Morena was at the end of her fold-over sheet, and she hesitated at her closing. Love was not a word that had made its way into their parlance, and yet she was certain it was implicitly true. She couldn't see how, given all that had happened, that there would be anything shocking about its introduction here. And so she wrote it in ink. Love, Morena. She followed this letter with very brief notes to her mother and Karen, in which she used most of her paper explaining why the note was so short. After all, the boat was leaving soon, and she didn't want to keep anyone waiting. She promised to start longer letters immediately and save them for the next departure. It was true that Anders had been impatient with the mail system. Several people had commented on that. He would take Easter to the river, and they would stand for hours waiting for anyone to paddle past. Then, when finally someone did, he would have the boy swim out with the letter and the money. Dr. Booty said he tried to get a letter in every boat that went by just to increase his chances that one or two might actually find their way home to his wife. But after a while, he was too sick to go down to the water himself, too sick to spend so many hours in the sun, and so he sent Easter alone. It did not require a great deal of inquiry on Marina's part to put this together, nor much conjecture to fill in the missing pieces. Anders, sick, wrote letters to his wife. Easter, worried, did not want to leave Anders for the amount of time it would have taken to find a boat going past. The traffic on their little tributary was thin at best, and on some days, not a single person floated by. While Easter would have understood the ritual of giving the blue envelopes to someone in a boat, he could not have understood what a letter was or what it represented, only that Anders wrote and wrote. He would have only just come back to the sleeping porch, and his friend would want to send him out again with another envelope. The first time Marina found one of those blue paper rectangles in her bed, perfectly sealed and addressed to Karen Ekman in Eden Prairie, she froze as solidly as a blood sample in the very bottom of the freezer. She leaned over the railing and shined the flashlight into the night jungle looking for a flash of Anders running away, her heart in full arrhythmia, but it didn't take her long to figure out who had delivered it. For Easter, these envelopes were his most precious possessions and therefore his best gifts. And because he knew he had come to them through a direct act of disobedience, they carry the added enticement of guilt. The letters were so secret he would not keep them in his lockbox with the feathers. Wherever they came from, he doled them out slowly, one every other day, every third day, beneath the sheet, beneath the pillow, folded in her extra dress.
Let me tell you the virtue of fever. It brings you here. I would have preferred it to take me home, and once or twice that's happened, but for the most part you arrive at 4 o'clock and take me out of this bed, and we walk through the jungle, and Karen, you know everything about the jungle. You know the names of all the spiders. You are afraid of nothing. I am afraid of nothing when you are here. Let me live in this fever. It is so much worse now, the hours I am well. Then nothing. Maybe these were the letters Anders didn't finish, the ones he started and forgot, and Easter picked them up off the floor while Anders slept and tucked them away. Of the three she had received so far, two were only paragraphs, and the third was a scant 2 sentences. What was the name of the couple who lived next door to us in the apartment building on Petite Court? I see them here constantly, and I cannot think of their names. Dr. Swenson had gone to her room at the back of the lab after being sick, and by the time she returned, everyone had finished his or her letter except for Dr. Booty, who seemed to approach the question of what to say as a spatial problem. She would stare for a long time at her paper and then turn her eyes up to the ceiling as if trying to calculate exactly how many words she needed to express her feelings and how many inches there were left on the paper for those words. Dr. Swenson returned after lunch looking like nothing had happened, and when Marina started to ask her how she was feeling, Dr. Swenson waved her away. Fine, she said without waiting for the question. Alan Saturn stood in front of Dr. Booty and tapped the table with his fingers. Give it up, he said.
You could have told me last night that you meant to go today.
She was a fine-boned woman of indeterminate age who wore her black hair in a single braid in the manner of the Lakashi. She folded her letter into thirds and ran her tongue along the glue strip.
Nothing happens here, Alan said. No one needs that much time to write a letter.
Dr. Booty reached into the pocket of the cotton smock she wore and pulled out several small bills, which she handed over to Dr. Saturn along with the envelope. Then, without further conversation, she returned her attention to her work. In her devotion to her task, Dr. Booty was an archetype of a particular sort in the medical community, as much as the ill-tempered surgeon or the addicted anesthesiologist. Anytime a group of doctors came together, there was always the one whose car would be in the parking lot when the others arrived at dawn, and whose car would still be there when the others pulled away after midnight. The one who was standing at the nurse's station at 4 a.m., reviewing the chart when it wasn't her weekend on call. The one the other doctors privately ridiculed for having no life, and yet with whom they felt a gnawing and irrational sense of competition. What was remarkable was how ably Dr. Booty filled this role even when there was no hospital,
no parking lot, and no patients. When all they did was work, Dr. Booty worked more. She claimed that she had already read all the Dickens.
Have you ever been to Java? Alan Saturn asked Morena. Anywhere in Indonesia?
She had followed him down to the dock with the Lakashi, not even asking herself why she was doing it. A departure, an arrival. She was beginning to see their appeal as a diversion. She was certain one of the men was wearing a pair of her pants rolled up at the cuffs. Pieces of her clothing walked by her from time to time, and there was nothing to do but watch them pass. She shook her head.
It's my theory that Booty is more suited to the tropics than the rest of us. This air, these smells, they must be second nature to her. She looks up so seldom I imagine she thinks she's home.
Dr. Saturn was working to loosen a knot in a rope that held the pontoon boat to the shore, and in his struggles he made the knot more intractable. Easter came down the dock and thumped him on the shoulder. His point was clear.
Now take Nancy and me coming from Michigan, he said. Well, that's going to be harder. It doesn't matter how long we're here or how often we come, we never fully acclimate. The foreignness of the place is always going to be a distraction for us.
Dr. Swenson was born in Maine, and she doesn't seem distracted.
Dr. Swenson may never be cited in conversations about how normal people respond to their environment.
Some freakish brand of great white bird with the wingspan of a pterodactyl flapped down the river towards them. It had a bare black head, a long black bill, and a red ring around its skinny neck. They all stood, paralyzed by the sight of it, watching until it took a hard left into the foliage and vanished. Dr. Saturn formed his hand into a visor against the afternoon sun.
Anders would have known what that was.
After a flurry of turning pages, Benoich held up the picture of the bird in Anders' book, thrilled to have found it so fast. He showed it to Dr. Saturn, who nodded approvingly at the correct match.
Jeribu stork, Dr. Saturn said.
Benoich, one of those young men who hoped for a career in tourism, had as a child been collected for a missionary school that had popped up briefly several tributaries away. Thanks to a group of Baptists from Alabama, he could read and write in Portuguese and had memorized Bible verses which he could recite at will, skills that had made him one of the least contented members of his tribe. Morena came over to look at the picture.
I've brought hats, Nancy Saturn said, coming down to the water. I have too. Now you can come with us.
She handed Morena a wide-brimmed hat, and when Morena hesitated, Dr. Saturn took it from his wife and put it on Morena's head. The age spans between the Doctors Saturn was greater than the span between Mr. Fox and Morena. One could imagine, though it had not been said, that he had once been her teacher. Morena recognized the way the wife leaned towards the husband when he spoke, as it was not unlike the way she had often leaned towards Dr. Swenson. In one late-night conversation over a bottle of Pisco brandy, in which the first Dr. Saturn was holding forth on matters of tropical medicine, the second Dr. Saturn actually took a notebook out of her pocket to write down something he had said. She was discreet, and the paper might have gone unnoticed had Dr. Swenson not asked her rather loudly if she wasn't capable of simply relying on her memory. Dr. Swenson leaned decisively away from the female Dr. Saturn, whom she clearly regarded as a gatecrasher, a hanger-on, though the younger woman, a botanist with a degree in public health, was probably best qualified to be of assistance. Certainly her credentials were closest to Dr. Rapp's.
I never rely on my memory when I'm drinking, was what Nancy Saturn had said.
Easter turned the key, and the motor of the pontoon boat began to spit and cough. All of the Lakashi pressed forward now, and Morena felt herself jostled from side to side by the shirtless men in running shorts and the women with their pregnant bellies. She found herself looking at their ears and the strings of seeds and animal teeth around their necks, and suddenly she realized she had not dreamed of India all week. Her father, who had been missing from her life for so many years, was gone again, and for an instant she had a vivid recreation of that hollow, hopeless feeling of having lost him in the crowd. As she wondered if the larium was out of her system now, a mosquito bit the back of her knee.
Jump, Alan said,
jumping onto the boat himself with the rope in his hand. Immediately, the current caught the boat and pulled it away from the shore. He turned around and reached his hand to Mirena. "The entire tribe is going to be on board in 5 seconds," he called. "Hesitation is the same thing as a straight-up invitation around here." It was true. The Lakashi were poised to begin boarding, all of them. Benoit pushed ahead of the pack and jumped without solicitation. He clearly meant to go somewhere, and Nancy followed him. Two more Lakashi leapt onto the boat, but before they had gotten their balance, Benoit tipped them back into the water, and then Mirena jumped without ever meaning to go. Easter laughed at her flat-footed landing, and she went and stood behind him, both of her hands on his shoulders. Every night, they went to sleep separately, he in his hammock and she in her cot beneath the netting, and every night his dreams woke them both. His dreams, not hers, and she would go and scoop him up, bring him back in with her where they would sleep out the rest of the night in her little bed. They had gotten good at it. In only a week, they had learned how to stretch and turn in unison. The Lakashi were wading into the river, and with the cross of breaststroke and dog paddle they favored, they swam. Mirena looked at their dark heads in the water and wondered if she would have swum out too, just to have something to do. Nancy Saturn removed her hat and waved it at them, showing the short auburn hair she cropped herself. She called out an enthusiastic series of farewells, goodbye in English and ciao in Portuguese, and then some sort of humming sound, followed by a high-pitched cry that essentially meant, "I am gone from you" in Lakashi. After her fourth or fifth repetition, they finally turned around and swam back to shore. It wasn't as if they ever would have caught the boat. Easter was gunning the engine now that Dr. Swenson wasn't on board. "They only want a little recognition," Nancy said, watching and waving as they fell farther and farther behind. "If you don't acknowledge what they're doing, they just keep doing it. Frankly, I don't think they're such good swimmers. You can't have half the tribe drowning on the way to the trading post." "Nancy would have made a great social behaviorist," Alan Saturn said, dropping a very tan arm over his wife's shoulders. "Dr. Rapp would have loved her. There were so many things we missed back then that Nancy picked up on the very first time she came out here."
"You knew Dr. Rapp?" Mirena asked.
Nancy raised her eyebrows briefly and then sighed with the recognition of what was to come. "How in the world did you miss that lecture?" she said, stepping out from under her husband's arm and rifling through her bag for sunblock and bug gel. She handed one tube to Mirena and began to use the other on herself. Alan Saturn lifted his sunglasses to better show the delight in his eyes. "I was his student at Harvard. I was actually enrolled in that famous mycology class the year he broke his ankle in New Guinea and wound up coming back to teach for the entire semester. Those were the lectures that were published by Oxford University Press, and there have been no end of papers written on them. I'm sure you must have read some of them. There were a great many legends built up around that class. It was listed in the catalog every year, but Dr. Rapp virtually never made his way back to the classroom for more than a day or two. In reality, it was taught by some graduate student who had been in the field himself and was qualified to do no more than read the notes and mark the tests. So, while studies in mycology was considered to be one of the seminal classes at the university, no one but rubes actually signed up for it. Signing up for the class was as good as admitting you had no idea what was going on, so who better than me to enroll? When people realized what had happened, that the great man himself was coming back to teach, you had a situation where seniors and graduate students, and in some cases faculty members, were making cash offers to freshmen to give up their seats. I, for one, stood firm and was rewarded fortunes beyond that $50 I turned down. I got to know Dr. Rapp that semester, I made sure of it, and so I was asked to travel with him in the Amazon for the next 3 summers in a row.
Is that how you met Dr. Swenson?
Mirena thought of her teacher taking the trouble to catch the red eye back from Manaus. To the best of her memory, Dr. Swenson hadn't missed a single class. Nancy Saturn smeared a great handful of white paste across her face and began to rub it in. To know Martin Rapp was to know Onyx Swenson.
"Don't ruin the story," Alan said to her.
He turned his attention back to Mirena,
that untapped source of listening pleasure.
Anik is several years older than I am, of course.
This news was delivered for his own vanity, as Alan Saturn, with his thinning white hair, enormous white eyebrows, and perilously slender ankles, could easily have been taken as older than Dr. Swenson. The only thing that made Dr. Saturn seem younger was his younger wife.
She was coming down here years before me. They were, shall we say, quite inseparable in the field.
She picked the boys who went on the trips, Nancy said. Only boys. She held interviews in his office at Harvard. She was the one who picked Alan. Dr. Rapp didn't have the time to fill the rosters himself.
Morena could see him then, a tall and lanky undergraduate, a canvas rucksack on his back.
You knew him too? She asked Nancy.
Nancy gave a small, snorting laugh and applied a layer of sunblock to her breastbone, reaching into the collar of her shirt to do the job right.
I came after Dr. Rapp.
Alan Saturn was ignoring her now. He was launched. A giant tree had fallen into the river, and the roots and branches reached up through the water as if begging to be saved. A bright yellow bird with a long, slender neck sat on one of those branches and watched the boat as it passed. Benoit, having spotted the bird, began his frantic turning of pages.
Martin Rapp was more than my teacher. He was the man I wanted to be. He was fully engaged with his life every minute that he lived it. He didn't trudge along doing what someone else told him to do. He was never a cog in the wheel. He held his head up and looked at the world around him. Now, my father was a very decent man, worked as a tailor in Detroit back when there were men in Detroit who had their suits made. He worked until his hands were so twisted with arthritis he couldn't hold a needle. If a man came into the store and told my father what he wanted, the only word my father had for him was yes. It didn't matter if it was a ridiculous order. Didn't matter if this guy showed up on Saturday morning and wanted his suit for Saturday night, and there was already work piled to the rafters. My father said yes. And once my father said yes, it was as good as done because that word was all he had in the world. He spent his life in the back room of a store, and the only thing he knew about his environment was that needle going in and out of the cloth. He did all this so my brothers and I could go to college and not be tailors, and have the luxury of telling somebody no someday. So off I went to Harvard, the tailor's boy from Michigan. The next thing I knew, I was sitting in a lecture hall, and in walked the great Martin Rapp. His ankles sunk in a plaster boot, his crutches swinging forward. He came up to the lectern and he said, "Gentlemen, close your books and listen. We have nothing less than the world to consider." We were awestruck, every last one of us. We would have sat there for the full 4 years of college. I remember everything about that day. That room, the giant blackboards, the light coming in those leaded glass windows. What I saw in front of me was the character of a man. It was the most remarkable thing, and I've never had that experience before or since. It was some sort of aura he had. From 10 rows away, I knew exactly who he was, and I knew I would follow him anywhere.
"Here," Nancy said to Morena, "take the sunblock and give me the bug gel." Morena took the sunblock, but there was only so much sunblock could do. As careful as she had tried to be, she was as dark as the natives now. Her own mother wouldn't recognize her.
"Listen to her," Alan said, declining to take the paste himself. "We didn't have sunblock back then. It was a melanoma that killed Dr. Rapp in the end. By the time they found it, it had spread everywhere there was for a melanoma to go. I cannot imagine all the years he spent in an open boat with no more than a straw hat and a white shirt for protection. It's amazing he lasted as long as he did. I came back to Cambridge to see him in the end, and he was every bit himself. He was interested in his own death, fascinated by it. He was taking notes. He was in his 80s then. He couldn't go out to the sights anymore. When I asked him if he still did his meditation, he said to me, 'Why would this time be any different?' That was the thing most people never knew about him. If he was in his house in Cambridge,
or he was in a tent in the driving rain outside Iquitos, he always meditated. And that's back in the days when only a handful of Indians and maybe a few Tibetans had even heard the word. He used to say, "We all had a compass inside of us, and what we needed to do was to find it and to follow it. But we were undergraduates, and for the most part, we couldn't find our asses with our hands, and so we followed his compass instead. Until we knew how to be men by our own standards, we tried to be men like Dr. Rapp. We never would be, of course, but it was still a noble goal. I look out over this river now, and I can see him, paddling the canoe along with the rest of us. In fact, we would have stopped paddling, crying like children about our blisters and our splinters, and he would just keep on. He wouldn't say a word, and then all of a sudden, he would turn the boat so hard we would nearly capsize. He would take it to the shore, and the next thing we knew, he was in the water and then into the jungle, gone, gone. And there we were, alone. 10 minutes later, he'd walk back out with a mushroom in a bag, a specimen that had never been recorded before. He'd be writing up the coordinates and taking pictures of the site, and then he was cleaning off the knife he'd used to cut the mushrooms from the tree on his handkerchief, the surest sign that the discovery was now complete. Everything he did was orchestrated. Every movement was beautiful. We boys would scramble into the jungle trying to figure out what he'd seen and how he'd known those mushrooms were there. And when we'd ask him, he would say, "I keep my eyes open." Alan Saturn was moved by the memory. "I keep my eyes open." That was the lesson. I have to tell you, those were the happiest summers of my life.